Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
What is The Briefing Room?
It's a behind-the-scenes look at how the criminal justice system works and the lives of the people within that system.
If you love true crime, well, these are the real people who do the job every day of making sure justice is served.
Hi, I'm Detective Dave.
I'm Detective Dan. Together, we have decades of experience in local law enforcement, a profession that we think is often misunderstood.
So we're going to explore how to do it right, and we won't shy away from when it's done wrong. These are stories you'll hear nowhere else. Unique, frank, and unvarnished.
From the team that brought you Small Town Dicks, this is The Briefing Room. Episode 1 drops on August 30th.
We'll meet you in The Briefing Room.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
And welcome back to Scarred for Life, the podcast where we open up old wounds by looking back at the films that scared us as kids. I'm Terry.
And I'm Mary Beth.
And each episode, our special guest brings with them a movie that traumatized them as a child.
This week, our guest is Nat Bremmer. He's a horror journalist and author who has written for Bloody Disgusting, Dread Central, Wicked Horror, and Diabolique Magazine, among others. His short stories can be found in places such as Sanitarium Magazine and Blood Bond. His latest book, Puppet Master Complete, A Franchise History, comes out on October 4th and is available to pre-order right now. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me. It's awesome to finally do this.
Yeah, I remember, I think it was a year or two ago when we were first talking about this, and you're like, I want to come on and talk about that. And I was thinking, well, we'll get to that in a minute. But I was thinking, 30th anniversary coming up, this would be perfect timing. And here we go. But before we do get into that, let's take it back to the beginning. How did you get introduced to horror?
It really goes all the way back. I was a monster kid from the first. I was watching Scooby-Doo and everything.
Yeah.
I remember there was an early 90s toy called Monster Face.
Monster Face.
That was
familiar.
Big rotting skull that would ooze, and you could put different noses and stuff on it. And I got that for Christmas when I was about 4 or 5. It terrified me. And I don't think my parents realized how much it terrified me, because we were in Maine, and my house was right set against the Maine woods. And when it gets dark in Maine, it gets pitch black. And this thing was set up in my room, this rotting skeleton head, this ghoulish mummified thing up in the window. And I remember, and I was probably 5, this memory, but there was a thunderstorm, and I was already scared and kind of under my covers, and I looked up, lightning streaked across the sky, so this thing was just illuminated in front of the window, and it's this haunting, haunting memory, but that was pretty early for me. And then I think I started to kind of get into the Universal Monsters, and then it was really first, second grade where I had one of my best childhood friends. I met him on his first day of school when he was a new kid. And I was all about the Universal Monsters because, it was a time when they were kind of weirdly for kids, because there was a Universal Monsters coloring book at the time.
Yep.
And they were Burger King Happy Meal toys at the time. So I was totally all about them and talking about them to everyone. And he just looks at me and he says, "What about Freddy and Jason?" I was who? And that was kind of the moment that opened it all the way up for me.
Wow. I have to go back to this monster face because I am jealous that you had one.
Oh, I was going to say good.
Because my parents wouldn't let me get one because there was slime involved. Like, I'm looking at the picture now and it just brought back all these memories of me wanting this box. My parents like, no, that's just going to make a mess in the house.
I had all the slimy stuff. I had that. I had the, like, the one that was like Creepy Crawler. It was like Dr. Demento's Laboratory or something. It was the one that was like Creepy Crawlers, but you could eat it.
Yeah.
And I had that too, but like Monster Face was the one that really like got me.
I mean, it's terrifying.
It's a terrifying mask. Good Lord.
Yeah. And it like oozes out of the pores and
the
stuff,
pores,
right?
Yeah.
That is so bizarre. But do you remember your first horror movie, Nat? The first one you ever saw?
Mm-hmm. It was after that, like, friend, the one that I always think of as, like, the first horror movie I saw was, that same friend who had kind of introduced me to the backstories of these characters for, like, weeks and, like, got everything wrong in retrospect. But he had been building up Jason in my head for weeks, and I was absolutely over the moon with, like, the mythology I was imagining in my head. So the first sleepover I ever had, we somehow convinced my mom to let us rent the original Friday the 13th.
Oh, wow.
And I was probably 7, but like, so it was like the first like overt gore I was seeing, but that didn't really mean as much to me by in terms of like the overall experience as much as when we got to the end. And then absolutely nothing that I had been told about this came to pass because there was no Jason. Right. Absolutely nothing I expected had happened. I was so mad at my friend and I was so jaded on the franchise at 7 that like when I got the opportunity to see another one, I jumped all the way to Jason Goes to Hell because his name was in the title.
That's funny. You know, I do think that a lot of kids might have that experience, though, where especially if they haven't, you know, if there's like a multiple of the Friday the 13th out, because I remember watching the first one. I talked about this when we were talking about that original movie in one of our recordings. But I expected there to be Jason in the first movie. And I was so confused that there's at the very end, it's revealed not to be Jason, you know. So I can understand that reaction.
If it wasn't for Scream coming out around the same time and me renting that, I might not have even like continued, because as soon as Scream said Jason showed up in Friday the 13th, you know, in the sequel, I took that as confirmation and I was like, okay, it's okay to continue. I wasn't lied to about this entire thing. It's not an elaborate con.
That's wild. Okay, so aside from the movie that we're talking today, what were you scared as a kid? And if you were, what other kind of movies do you remember scaring you?
In terms of like writing horror, I feel lucky about this, but I was really scared by a lot of things. And I still get pretty easily scared by some movies. A really well-constructed scare sequence, and sometimes not even that well constructed of a scare sequence can still get me pretty good. It was movies like this. It was like the randomest crap would traumatize me when I was young. And even when I started watching like actual like monster movies, or even like right before, but like there was an episode of Eureka's Castle where the big, I don't know, the big fluffy dragon thing has a nightmare about like the boogeyman, and their weird knockoff Jim Henson interpretation of the boogeyman was just like unacceptable to me. It really bothered me. And in terms of movies, like when I really started to see some, I think two of the like adult horror movies that scared me the most when I was a kid were Salem's Lot and Creepshow, the Crate Story in particular, because my parents were kind of like they censored some things but not others. My mom had this weird rule where like she felt that like yesterday's R was today's PG-13, so I could watch anything that was made in the 80s or before. Which was categorically untrue, because the MPAA had crushed down so hard like by the 90s. So the stuff the stuff we were getting at the time that I wasn't allowed to see, like Scream and I Know What You Did Last Summer, were so much tamer than like the slasher movies that came before them. Mm-hmm. But there was another weird blind spot that my parents had and a lot of parents had, where because we were in Maine, if it was Stephen King, it was fine.
Oh,
interesting. Really?
Yeah. So that's why I was seeing like Salem's Lot and Creepshow in like second grade and absolutely terrified. I think one of the first movies to really, really terrify me was Salem's Lot. Mm-hmm. Like so much of the imagery, because Creepshow was just the crate. But, like, everything else was more or less fine. I wasn't scared of, like, Stephen King turning into a plant. It was really just the monkey thing in the crate that bothered me. But, Salem's Lot and that, they were two of the first to really, like, really get me.
So I'm always fascinated when people have, you know, grew up in Maine or lived in Maine. Did you ever see Stephen King?
Yes. Literally. Like people don't understand like how much of a possibility that is and what it really is like in Maine. Like I went to high school with his nephew. We were in the same friend circle. The last time I had a friend a few years ago who lived in Bangor and had never gone to see the house. And I was like, what are you doing? Like you've lived here for like over a year at this point. You've never
That'd be
gone
my first stop.
Yeah. You've never gone to like see the Stephen King house. Like everybody, you know, goes to drive by it at least once. So I was like, let's go right now. And so we got into the car and we just drove, and literally as we were driving by the house, he and Tabitha were outside walking the corgi.
The corgi.
That's amazing.
Wow.
The thing of evil.
Mm-hmm.
Huh. Wait, wow. So do you still live in Maine, Nat?
No.
So what draws you to the horror genre now as an adult?
Kind of a lot of the same talking points that, you know, we all kind of gravitate to, like being in this and writing about this. We've all, you know, probably read a lot of the same books, because it was about when I was in high school that I started to realize that there was actual like meaning, which was hugely important to me, because like at that time, this was only like the thing I was supposed to have grown out of. And hadn't yet. So it was so like validating when I found those first things that were like, hey, here's what like Night of the Living Dead is really about and everything. And it kind of like really opened up the floodgates for me in terms of like taking it seriously. I think a thing that helped me as a teen, like really, really get into it in the kind of way that I've evolved and really gotten into it since is, sounds silly, but Bravo's 100 Scariest Movie Moments.
Okay.
Oh, really?
That whole special. Like, I was like 15 and I saw like so many movies. Like, I literally, the second time that it played or that I caught it on TV, I like went back with a pen and paper to write down the titles of the things I hadn't seen.
Oh, cool.
And so that was when I jumped up from like, I'd been, you know, raised on like the Freddy and Jason and Chucky era, which I still loved, but then that was kind of the moment that started gearing me towards movies like Audition.
Okay.
Oh, cool.
Yeah. So I know that you said that you still do get scared as an adult. Do you remember the last movie that really, really terrified you?
I know there's been others since, but it's maybe in my head because I rewatched it a couple months ago, but Sinister was the last one that like really got me in terms of like some of the sequences, but also just kind of underlying like hopelessness of it.
Yes. Yeah.
Because like one, it's viscerally scary, but also nobody's going to be okay. So there's like really no end to like peeling back like this horrible, rotten onion that it is in a good way.
Mm-hmm. And let's talk about some of those images.
Yeah, because I watched it recently. Because there was something a while ago that was like Sinister is one of the scariest movies ever made. And I was like, is it? And I watched it again, and I don't know if it's the scariest movie ever made, but I forgot how fucked up a lot of those kind of like found footage 8mm sequences are, and how just absolutely gruesome it is, especially for a movie that I know was like a pretty big kind of like blockbustery release when it came out. Like it was really, really graphic, especially because it killed kids, and like that always is very like taboo.
Taboo,
especially like more mainstream audiences.
Yeah. Okay, so how did you get introduced to writing fiction? Because you're kind of, you both write fiction and also you write about movies. So how did you kind of get into both of those hemispheres of writing?
That one, like, literally goes back as far as I can remember. Like, I was writing, like, weird, awful ghost stories and stuff, like, in first grade when I was okay. supposed to be, like, doing grammar or something. Like, that one is really, like, as far back as I can remember. And then it was about in high school that I had a really great English teacher who was like, you know, like, you're gonna do this. Like she didn't want to say, like, you know, actually, she kind of did say that we don't have a lot of, you know, writers come through here that are, like, not only a lot of people probably have the grasp, like, to do it, but know, like, what they want to do with it.
Okay.
Yeah.
She could see that, like, the ideas were there and, like, they needed to be refined and everything, but that was kind of the first thing that set me on the path of, like, I think I can do this for myself. And then it was, like, freshman, sophomore year of college that I wrote a short story, and the professor in the fiction class was like, you should submit this somewhere, which I had never even, like, considered before. Right. But I was like, okay, and I did, and it got accepted into this little, like, zine and everything, but that was, like, huge.
That's
huge
amazing.
To me.
That's so cool.
Like, give it up for English teachers.
I was just going to say the same thing. Like, give it up for teachers who really, like, care and nurture their students. And I'm like, you can do this. Like, that makes the biggest difference. I feel like so many of us who are writers, like, have a cool English teacher who was like, you are actually really talented. You should do it. And you're like, oh, maybe I should.
Yeah. Yeah. It made a huge difference.
Yeah. And so in writing, you've written a book. Is this your first book?
I did a lot of, like, self-publishing in college and stuff, and, like, putting out some stuff on my own. And the Puppet Master book is the first, like, book I've got, like, with a big publisher behind it. That's a whole, or at least that I'm not just a contributor to.
Mm-hmm.
Like, my first book on my own through a big publisher. So it's really, really been an interesting experience.
That's so exciting. So why? Okay. So obviously you love Puppet Master, but what is your relationship to the franchise? Like, and why did you want to write about it?
It was literally, like, my biggest childhood obsession. It really just got its hooks in, like, deep in me. And it started when I was in third grade. It didn't even start by, like, me, like, begging my parents to let me pick up a Fangoria or anything. It was pretty harmless. I got a toy magazine.
Mm.
It was, like, an X-Men on the cover. Because, you know, I wanted some Mr. Sinister. And I opened it up. And there was this big two-page spread on the Puppet Master action figure series. And it was just seeing the designs of the characters and the puppets, I was, like, hooked. And there was, like, something in the corner that was, like, based on, like, the movies and whatever. I was like, I have to see these movies. I have to see what this is. I have to know everything about this right now. And then, like, I begged my dad to let me rent the first movie. And it was immediate, like, just love at first sight for a young fan. Like, I was all about it. And the video store was, like, huge for me. I'd go down, like, every weekend. And I got to a point where I kind of, like, stopped renting things because they had the first three Puppet Masters, and I would pretty much just rent those over and over.
I love that. So this has to be, what, there's, like, four? Is there 14 of them?
There are 14. And two of them came out since I started writing the book.
Oh, my gosh.
Oh, God.
That was when, like, they kind of announced another one. I was like, okay, the book has to just come out. Because if I keep adding chapters for future movies, like,
it'll be 20 years down the line.
Yeah, Charlie Band is going to make Puppet Master movies until the sun burns out of the sky. So I have to just stop it and say, okay, this is the book. Here it is. It covers these 14 films that are currently out. But that was kind of the biggest thing of why it took, like, so long to write, because
every time you turn around, there's a new one, it seems like.
Yeah. The reboot hadn't come out yet. And the first time I wrote that chapter, it was on a movie that, like, I thought the book was going to, like, coincide with. So I wasn't really talking about it. And then I had to like draft that again, like after it came out and everything. And so it's been a weird kind of interesting thing evolving like with the franchise.
So, okay. So I'm a newbie to the Puppet Master series. I have seen the one that came out, 2018 maybe, with Barbara Crampton was in it.
Yeah. Yeah. And that is wild because that's the one probably most people have seen because it was like a bigger release. Like it was theatrical for one night only, which is more than any other Puppet Master movie it ever had.
I was gonna say these are all direct to video, right?
Yeah, totally. And that movie is the total antithesis of what literally all of the other movies are, to the point where the franchise as a whole is about the it's like part of one of the things that I find interesting about it. It's kind of the only inherently Jewish horror franchise, at least, in that it is about the souls of Nazi victims who have been placed kind of into these bodies to kind of keep going and get their revenge. And that kind of is the lore established in the third movie, which is kind of the favorite. The reboot is about puppets that are Nazis. And exclusively commit hate crimes. And I know it's done in a tongue-in-cheek kind of way, but it's still like a night and day difference.
It made me really uncomfortable.
Yeah.
That movie made me really uncomfortable, I'm going to be honest.
Yeah, and to be really honest, it's like a tough chapter for me because I've been writing this book so long that like I wrote that final chapter on the reboot right after it had come out. So I was like, oh, this wasn't for me, but like I get what they were doing. And as time has gone on and on, like since that chapter has been locked and it's kind of like basically say that, but I've gone to like it less and less. I was like, yeah, this isn't for me. And like, I gave them the benefit of the doubt because, you know, I know it was kind of a more dark humorous approach and it's just kind of going for a trauma thing. So it's not like, you know, then it's got a great cast. I was like, but the company that made it is all in bed with Ben Shapiro now.
That's a movie that like I didn't like when it came out, and then the more and more it, like as the years go on, I'm like,
Wow, I forgot about that production company.
Yeah.
Wow.
And so like the franchise like overall, like, yeah, that lore might not have come into play overtly until like the third movie, but the literal first scene of the first film is the old puppet master shooting himself so the Nazis don't get their hands on him and his puppets.
Oh, wow.
So it's still like completely the opposite of what this thing was even to begin with. Because even when the puppets, part of what I love about it is it's the only franchise where the characters, like your icons of the franchise, can be good or bad depending on the entry. So like there are movies where they kill people and there are movies where they flat out don't. They fight puppet-sized demons and they play laser tag and they have a great time. It is such a beautifully weird franchise, and that's the thing that kind of always stuck out to me. It's like even in the movies where they are the villains, they're not the villains like by the end, because in the movies where there's like a larger person like pulling the strings, the puppets still eventually turn coat on them. And so like there's no Friday the 13th thing where it's like, oh, the puppets were discarded, like how are they gonna come back in the next one. It's either like they're the heroes or the anti-heroes depending on so unless with the exception of like the character of Leech Woman, who was killed off because they just thought she was too gross, they're not like discarded from movie to movie.
So for newbies like me, Mary Beth, have you ever watched any of them?
I have not.
Where is a good place to start? From the beginning, or is there like a place that you recommend people start from?
I always kind of recommend the third, because the third is a prequel anyway. So it's set in World War II. It's set before everything. So kind of even the movies that were made before it all kind of have the context of that movie as the starting point for everything. And that movie just feels so much more expensive than it okay. is, because Dave Dakota directed that, and he got...
Oh, okay.
Dave Dakota directed four of these damn movies.
Wow.
But he got the Universal backlot for that film. So, like, the exteriors are shot at Universal, and it feels... And it's like World War II, and it feels so much bigger than these tiny, tiny straight-to-video movies that it is. And it's got, like, this cast of great European actors and everything. All these great character actors in it. And it feels like, you know, as much as I love various ones for various reasons, it really, not even in the franchise, but of Full Moon in general, kind of comes out of nowhere. It's like, this is a legitimately, like, good movie.
Wow.
Hmm.
Okay.
Okay.
Before we move on, your book, what is in it? Is it just going through each movie, or how is it laid out?
The thing to me, and I was really kind of adamant about this even from like the very first like book proposal, is to me the franchise and like the merchandise are intertwined, because Charlie Band, you know, he's a showman. He's really out there peddling his wares all the time. And so like from the get-go, these movies have had tie-ins that kind of feed directly into one another, to the point that like the action figures came out, and then they had to make a movie to kind of promote the action figures because they hadn't made a movie in a few years.
Gotcha.
And then they made another toy line, and they were like, oh, well, then we're just going to make a movie. Like, it got to a point where they were making a movie based on the toys instead of vice versa.
Wow.
And then, you know, in the past, like, decade or so, they've done, like, replicas, and they'll, you know, put a version of, you know, the puppet in the movie to look like the replica they're making. And so the book covers, in total, all 14 now films, two comic series, and an action figure series, and those are the chapters.
Wow.
Cool. Ooh, I'm excited to read it.
Wow.
And learn more about this franchise.
Yeah, it was definitely written with the notion in mind that a lot of people haven't seen it, even in the horror genre, have missed the whole thing. And so, you know, it's also like, okay, well, in general, like, here's how this thing that was designed to cater to the then booming market of video stores wound up surviving video stores.
Okay,
that's the thing that I think is interesting, whether you've seen it or not. And, you know, a lot of people have seen it, don't understand why someone would write a book about it. And that was the more therapeutic aspect to me, was going through the book being like, but why am I doing this?
Well, you know, I was thinking, because this, none of them have been released really to theaters, and yet I've never seen them, and yet I was familiar with them. The creatures, the puppets, they are all iconic. I mean, you look at them and like, oh, that's a Puppet Master. Those are, I don't know their names, but those are all characters that I associate with Puppet Master. So the fact that this movie that has never had a theatrical release, that a lot of people like me have never seen, still has like takes up a place in our collective horror knowledge is kind of wild.
There are toys celebrated on the shelves at Target now.
Oh, are there really?
Yeah, like Walmart and Target, because NECA, the toy company, they did Puppet Master figures this year, so there are now Puppet Master toys on the shelves at like the biggest possible retailers, and this is a straight to video thing.
That's wild. That's wild to me.
Yeah.
Nat, what movie did you bring with you today for us to discuss?
I brought in a movie called Ernest Scared Stupid.
Hell yeah.
Which I, you know, as a listener was like, I can't believe nobody's covered Ernest Scared Stupid yet. And eventually I got to a point that made me feel really confident to come on and do this, where I was like, maybe people weren't as terrified as of Ernest Scared Stupid as I was.
So, okay. For those of you who are not familiar with Ernest Scared Stupid, Ernest P. Worrell, who is a franchise, which we'll talk about, accidentally unleashes an ugly troll that plots to transform children into wooden dolls in the town of Briarville, Missouri. Okay, so before we jump in, Nat, to why you chose this movie specifically, can we give everyone, including myself, some context on Ernest and who he is? Because I've heard of Ernest Scared Stupid. I've heard of like the Ernest goes to jail. Like, those, I've heard of them, but I have absolutely no familiarity with, like, the character, the franchise, the antics. So can you guys give me a lowdown on it?
Sure.
Ernest is like a redneck Mr. Magoo. Like, he just keeps finding his way into terrible situations. And, like, he started out, I believe, as a commercial.
He did. He was a fictional character created by a Nashville advertising agency to use in local ad campaigns, and then got so, like, popular that he got national ads for, like, Coca-Cola, for Mellow Yellow, which is the ad that I remember.
Hey, Vern. It sure is hot up here, Vern. I bet you'd like a cold, smooth Mellow Yellow right now, would you? Yeah, I just bet you would. You know, Vern, there's nothing like a good old cold Mellow Yellow when you're all hot and sweaty. I think it sure beats that Mountain Dew. You know what that sound means in Russia, Vern? Empty. Vern,
Chex, Taco John's, like a bunch of these, like, advertising firms across the country, and it would always be him walking up to the door of Vern, his neighbor, who you never see, never hear. And he's always, like, you know, trying to hawk something. He's like, oh, you know, and has that kind of down to earth sort of, like, charm that his character has. And he's like, you know what I mean, Vern? Like, that has became kind of his like catchphrase, from what I remember correctly. Is that how you remember it, Nat?
Yes, it is. My dad was a fan of, like, really stupid comedy. So it was my dad that kind of got me into Ernest movies in general. But I was already, like, a monster kid and a Halloween kid. So it was this Ernest movie, even though I'd seen Ernest Goes to Camp and Ernest Saves Christmas and Ernest Goes to Jail.
Where he gets electrocuted in an electric chair, gets magnetized, flies.
Yeah. We're really going to get into the indestructibility of Ernest. Absolutely, because...
Yes.
Yeah, I'd seen all these movies, but this one, he's... And, like, I think he has a different job in every movie, so he's the typical, he, like, sanitation worker. But it was this movie that I wanted to see the most, and I don't think I need to clarify that no other Ernest movie terrified me like this one did.
Yeah, so they were released, the first five were released theatrically. We had Goes to Camp, Saves Christmas, Goes to Jail, Scared Stupid, and then Ernest Rides Again. And then Ernest Rides Again failed spectacularly, I guess, at the box office. And so then they made four more that were released direct to video. And like you said, in every movie, he plays a kind of a different job, but he's always a working class bachelor. Yep. And he's working at places like a gas station or a janitor, a sanitation worker, a construction worker. Like, these are the jobs that he always has. And the actor, Jim Varney, had a lot of characters that he would portray. Sort of like how Eddie Murphy does it with, like, you know, the Clumps and Clumps. Was it the Clumps?
Yep.
And all of those, like, where he would play different roles. Like, that's kind of been his shtick from the beginning.
Okay.
Does that make sense, Mary Beth?
Yes, it does.
Wild,
I got
right?
that vibe. Yeah. Wow.
He won a daytime Emmy too. For his sketch show.
Shit.
Yeah, he had, like, a TV series on Saturday morning sketch show. Hey Vern, it's Ernest, I believe is what it was called. And he won a daytime Emmy for it.
Wait, so this guy was fucking huge.
Yeah, he was big. He was ubiquitous in, like, the 80s. Like, that was, I remember seeing commercials, even up in Alaska, I remember seeing commercials for a bunch of the products that he was hawking. And then the movies. Ooh. I saw them all. I saw them all in theaters.
So, okay, hold on. So he started as an advertising character.
Yep. Yeah, he was created by an advertising firm.
And then he
firm.
Became, that's wild to me. Isn't that always weird when that happens? I feel like that doesn't happen super often, but when, like, a marketing figure becomes its own franchise of movies.
I do think that might have happened a bit more, like, in that time period. Because I'm thinking about, like, how the Noid from Domino's got his own video game.
Wait, he's from look how much I know. I'm just like,
I'm right. Isn't it Domino's? Isn't the Noid? I think the Noid is from Domino's.
I have no idea.
Yeah, it was an advertising character created for Domino's Pizza.
Wow.
So I do think that that was like more of a thing in like the 80s. You would see that. But I always like consider him sort of I like that you, Nat, called him sort of like the a redneck or the, you know, working class Mr. Magoo. I always considered him in the same line as like Pee Wee in terms of like.
Okay.
That kind of man-child, kind of like otherworldly, above, like above and beyond, like humanity kind of character is how I always saw him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
He's like very slapstick. Yes. And because we'll talk about them more, I think. But like I knew this was like a little bit more geared towards kids. But wow, really, really, really leans into like the slapstick, the crazy facial expressions, like very mm-hmm. much man-child. Very much. I got more Pee-wee for sure. That's who I was thinking of when I was watching this, was Pee-wee. And why did we have so many of those man-children as our as like our like cultural touch points during that time? Why? Anyway, I'm getting ahead of myself. I'm sorry. It's like Ernest as a concept is like incredibly baffling. Not baffling, but it's just I think the concept of having so many man children as like these figures makes me like, why? Why though? I don't understand it.
Yeah, I got nothing. It was a wild time. Well, and you think about it too. That it's also weird because this is all happening in the 80s when the height of like fear of kids being kidnapped, of boys being kidnapped and murdered.
Yes, and Ernest does more than once in this film.
And you have that, right? And so then you're teaching these kids that hanging out with this adult man who is in all of these movies, because I remember him, I'm pretty sure he hung out with kids in all of the movies because mm-hmm. they were centered for kids. And we're kind of doing that with this character at the same time that we're like, stranger danger, be afraid because you're going to get kidnapped and murdered. It's wild.
They're just like the kids, like in the movie, in this movie particularly, like this sheriff's kid and another girl just chilling in his trash truck.
As one does, Mary Beth.
As one does. Like you just chill out with the local sanitation worker. Like, I have a question. Okay. We need to get to the movie. I'm sorry. Never mind. We can get right to the movie. I just have so many questions and thoughts. But anyway, about Ernest P. Worrell.
Okay. So, Nat, so we've kind of set the scene. How did you see this movie? Why did you see this movie? I want to hear everything. Give us your horror story about Ernest Scared Stupid and why it scarred you for life.
It's weird. Like, my memories of first seeing it are hazy. I think I rented it.
Okay.
And I think it was around Halloween time because my dad would rent all of the Ernest movies, so it was just another Ernest movie. And I think I had seen at least some, like, inkling, because I was really young, some inkling of adult horror before this, and I would see this movie, you know, again, even after I had seen actual R-rated horror movies, and this would still terrify me more.
Really?
Like, from the get-go. And like really, really badly too, not in the way I was like scared of other things. Like it would linger. And I think I was just totally disarmed because initially it's just an Ernest movie and it's as stupid and ridiculous and low rent and cheap as like any Ernest movie until there are these scares that are crafted like for adults. Like, they are, I don't care what anyone says, they are built to traumatize. In particular, the scene where the girl who already knows there's a troll mm-hmm. is begging her mother to check under the bed, and she doesn't, so she goes down herself, and there's nothing. And then she rolls back onto the bed, and there's the troll. Or yep. troll, like, the kid falls down in the gully, and the troll uses Ernest's voice to be like, I got you, buddy.
Oh, yes.
Fuck that.
You know, I kind of thought that those were the scenes because, like, watching it now, I was amazed at how they are crafted as if they are like in an adult horror movie. Like, it's a little cutesy now for me as an adult watching it and turning around. There's that, you know, the troll, but like the way that it's crafted, it reminds me of like taking things from It, from Pennywise, kind of like calling mm-hmm. the kids out from under the sewer, where he's like, he's using Elizabeth's voice and is like trying to get coax Kenny into the pipe and all of these types of, and then taunting him later. It's like, I'm catching up to you, Kenny. Mm-hmm. You know, it definitely has that kind of adult-esque craft to it.
And this is like a natural progression because the thing that basically first inspired it was Stephen King walking over a sewer grate and thinking of the three Billy Goats Gruff, which, by the way,
trolls.
That's it. Like, this scared me so badly that I became afraid of trolls in general. Could not, because of this movie, I could not listen or, like, have anybody read to me the three Billy Goats Gruff because I was imagining this troll. I went to Disney World and there was a ride at Epcot called Maelstrom, which is like going on a boat ride through Norway, and there was a three-headed troll, and in my mind that was three Trantor heads. They were absolutely going to eat me.
Wow, so this really actually affected you after watching the movie then too.
Really did, in an abnormal way. And like, I knew like other people were like afraid of it, but like, it really hit me over time that like, I was more scared of that than other people. Especially when I met like the Kyoto brothers a few years ago, and I was like, that movie was like the most traumatic thing of my childhood. And they're like, what? Honestly, wasn't expecting that.
That's amazing that you met them, by the way.
It was at like a convention, and I got to talk with them for a bit. I got fairly kind of lightly roasted for how scared of the movie I had been.
I mean, because they've done like, you know, Critters and Killer Clowns, and it was this movie.
Mm-hmm. Okay, but I will say, they really knocked it out of the park with some Nasty Boys.
Yes.
Like, snot-covered Nasty Boys. Mm-hmm. Really killed it.
This is a very snotty movie, although I will say that it's not as goopy as I remembered it. In my mind, I saw this movie in movie theaters. I remember seeing it in the theater. I remember in particular, and I thought, I didn't know if this was like a mismemory or whatever, but I did go look, and there is, and I did find that an ad for it. There was a trailer, and I remember seeing this trailer before I ended up seeing the movie, and it was like a girl running through a forest, and it was like, it had that narrator voice, you know, but first there was Jason, then there was Freddy, now, and then it was Ernest Scared Stupid. It was a close up on Ernest's face going, you know, that kind of face he does when he's first introduced in this. And I remember seeing that ad and being like, oh my gosh, This is going to be in the same league as Jason and Freddy. I remember, because that was what was in my mind before I went into to see this movie. And I do remember loving it as a kid, but I also remember it being far goopier than it actually is. I mean, there's a couple really kind of snotty, gross moments in it. But for some reason, in my mind, a lot of the, like, there's egg sacs that grow in the tree and all this stuff. I remember for some reason it being just goopier. That it ended up being.
Oh, he also says snot quite a bit in this movie, and I feel like he says snot more than you really see snot, if that makes sense.
Yep.
Like, the troll is covered in boogers. Oh, and of course, yes, it's boogers, because sure we all know how kids feel about boogers, and we all know that kids love to laugh at boogers. Ha 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 ha. Kids are so gross. But, like, you know, it is, they just keep saying snot. Mm-hmm. And I hate that word. I really hate it. I hate it.
Yeah, it is comparatively like goopier, less goopy than it could have been. Like, all things considered, for the fact that he has two noses, the troll kind of has things under control.
He really does. Wow. Okay, so this was your first watch, Mary Beth, I have to ask.
Yes, this was my first watch. I had fun. Cute's not the right word. It's not cute, but it's definitely a kid's movie. But it's fun. It's a kid's movie, but it's definitely one of those kid's movies where I was watching it, and I'm like, yeah, this would fuck up a lot of kids. Like, I am surprised that not as many people have brought it up, because it's like, the troll is creepy. Like, I would have been scared of that as a kid. But also the way the kids are transformed into wood and, like, taken away. And there's, like, the stakes are a little bit higher. But the other thing that there's two things. One, Eartha Kitt is in this movie, which is incredible. and she kind of looks like Doc Brown. Yes. But better. Like she's
she does.
She looks like Doc Brown. She has huge, huge gray hair, and she's the witch of the town and lives on like the property outside of town that looks like it's covered in trash, but it's actually art. And her and Ernest have a very silly, cute little confrontation in scare quotes where he says, "I'm just here to throw, like, to take out the garbage." And she goes, "Got no garbage here, only representations of the soul." Like, she is just. She is that character I feel like they wrote for the adults to really, because like, one, kids aren't going to know who Eartha Kitt is. So I feel like having Eartha Kitt in this movie is like a, hey, here's that, like a recognizable figure for the adults. And also she's kind of the funny adult line person in the movie to me as well. It's kind of how I saw her.
Girl, she has great lines.
She does. Oh, she calls him the Great Redneck Hope too, because he's the one that she reveals like the whole curse that he has, like he is the, how do I describe this? He is the relative, like, descendant of a warl who entombed the troll centuries ago. And she says to him, "You are the seventh son of the seventh son. You are the you are the baby. You are the boy. It is your legacy. You are the Great Redneck Hope." And then, like, he steps back into a light and goes, "I am the Great Redneck Hope." And I was like, this movie is ridiculous. Like, this is amazing. So, yes, I wanted to mention Eartha Kitt because she's incredible in this movie.
I love that there's, like, Ernest family backstory here. So that, you know, you have the canon now. So that no matter what movie you're watching, be it whether he's saving Christmas or getting incarcerated, you know, no matter what movie it is, you will always have that foundation that Ernest is an idiot because his great-great-grandfather buried a troll.
So, okay, where is this in the chronology of Ernest movies? Do you know, anyone know off the top of their head? Like, are there movies after this one, basically?
Yes.
Okay.
There are movies after this one.
So that means that this entire town in canon has also been traumatized by trolls that have popped out of the ground. Is that ever brought up again in any of these movies? Like, does anyone, you know, try to reconcile, like, the humongous trauma, collective trauma they have all gone through?
I don't know if there is, like, an Ernest cinematic universe.
But I would like to think there is, because what was making me laugh, not laugh, but watching this was, like, this is, like, this is an entire town that is just going to have to live with this. And, like, what is that like to be in a town that goes through this and is like, well, I guess we just have to, like, either never talk about this again or somehow reckon with our ridiculous traumatic past of our town. Like, that's incredible. What the heck?
Well, and I kind of think that there probably isn't a cinematic universe because, like I said, in the movie that preceded this, Ernest goes to jail. He gets sent to the electric chair for a crime he didn't commit. And then ends up gaining superhuman abilities to shoot lightning bolts and fly.
Yes.
And it becomes like a superhero movie from what I remember at the very
this
end
sounds
of this.
Better than the Marvel Cinematic Universe.
And so that was the movie before this one. So by this time he is shucked off all of his powers and he's just a normal person again. So I don't think they probably had the foresight to like create.
Normal person, though, is a stretch because, again, we have like a whole elaborate and long Final Destination type set piece at the beginning of this movie, introducing Ernest by running him through a trash compactor. Basically to announce that there are no stakes because you have literally killed Ernest at the start of the film so that the troll could obviously do nothing to him. So you're never going to worry about Ernest's safety from this point on. Eartha Kitt literally sets him on fire. Like,
you know, I was thinking, because Mary Beth and I were kind of talking through text before this, and I was honestly, I consider him more like a Bugs Bunny, like a live action Bugs Bunny. Like, things will happen to him. You know, he's in danger. He gets hurt. He gets burnt. He gets trash compacted. He has the trash can slammed down on his fingers that would have probably cut off his fingers. I mean, he's been to the electric chair. Like, he seems like he's a cartoon character brought to life in a lot of ways.
Yeah, very much so.
He definitely is. And this Jim Varney, right? he's got a rubber face.
Yeah. He sure does.
He's great for this. He is incredible, I will say. And especially when it's all of a sudden Ernest is changing personalities.
Okay,
twice, I think, right?
Yes.
Twice? Okay.
Yeah, once for no reason, and then once when they all step in to fight the trolls at the end.
And then, does this happen in all the other movies?
What I remember is that they were actual disguises in the other movies that he would slip into. Mm-hmm. Like, he was a master of disguise, and he would just play these different characters, and people would actually see them. And so I was trying to reconcile that with this movie, because I'm pretty sure they were just figments of his imagination. Because at one point, Kenny makes that comment about how he's up here fighting them with his multiple personalities.
With the multiple, like, personality brigade. Yeah, it's just like he's had the disguises in so many other movies that maybe now, like, he's lost the root of who the true Ernest is. And they're all just jumbled together. He's like, which one of these is me?
So which one of these is Ernest? Ernest Scared Stupid is also Ernest Scared Into an Identity Crisis.
Yes.
Incredible. Okay, because, like, you know, he is seen as, like, a woman with, like, a big beehive hair, as, like,
the woman with the neck brace is my favorite.
Woman with the neck brace. There's, like, a lumberjack. There's a character that's an Ottoman that I think he's, like, kind of in brown face for.
Yeah, that was uncomfortable.
I was like, is that brown face? No, that is 100% brown face.
That was uncomfortable.
That was very uncomfortable. I was like, did that really just happen? There's like a Greek, like a kind of like a Greek emperor. There's a bunch of there's a bunch of them.
Yeah.
Am I missing?
And the lumberjack is my favorite, who says, you know, no, there are no trees in Botswana. I am a Botswanian lumberjack and I have never had a job.
I know. Like, they said it so fast and I was like, wait, hold on. I have to rewind. Did he really just say that?
There are a lot of those moments where it's like quick fire jokes that, like, if you're not paying attention, are just going to, like, fly over your head.
Mm-hmm.
It's very, very fast, and it reminds me of, like, it's pacing for kids, you know what I mean? Like, it's like a million jokes at once to see which sticks, and, like, mm-hmm. Ooh, and that's how I kind of felt. It was just, like, he was almost mumbling the whole time, where I was like, what is he, like, what are you saying? What is the joke? And sometimes the joke would land, and other times I'd be like, I didn't have time to process anything that you just said.
So he has, like, according to Wikipedia, he has a family of 15 people that he has portrayed either in movies or in his stand-up routine, including...
Stand-up? Good Lord.
Yeah. Including one that I am just now learning about, whose name was Dingus Worrell and was a potato who Ernest said came over during the potato famine and went on to become a yam magnet. So,
is it an actual potato?
I guess. I need to do some digging into this because I just literally saw that on this page. But yeah, he plays all these different characters. And in this one, I like this idea, Dad, that he just is having an identity crisis for sure. Because I was really confused because I literally remember him donning all these different, you know, disguises to get out of things. Mm-hmm. And in here, I thought that's what he was doing at first. He was playing an elaborate, like, storytelling scheme. And I was thinking of how long that would take for him to keep switching characters and putting on all these different costumes. But then I realized, no, that's all in his head.
Mm-hmm.
And that's,
wow.
That's wild. It kind of takes a dark turn for a kid's
I've always wondered what that looks like. What that looked like to Kenny. What was Kenny seeing?
That was my thing. I was like, you're telling this kid a story, but you're not obviously not in costume. So, like, what is this kid experiencing? And what does this kid actually think of you? Like, did any of you ever have, like, a weird neighbor or, like, a weird neighborhood dude that, like, you kind of all tolerated but thought he was a little weird? Did any of you guys have that experience? Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yes, absolutely. Especially living in Alaska. Absolutely.
Ah, oh.
There was a lot of weird people in Alaska.
Neighbors are, especially, it's always, I've always had such weird neighbors.
I was just thinking, I remember, it wasn't a man, but I remember this woman that lived up the street and she would walk around with her giant snake. Like, to me, it was like an anaconda. I don't know how big the snake actually was, but she would be walking around in her yard with the snake dangling around her neck. And that's, was like three houses down from us. Like, that's what I kind of remember. So,
okay.
Yeah.
Wow.
So we're having a real breakthrough here because I've never made this connection before this moment. But my dad was really great friends and he was over all the time. He was wonderful, but my dad was great friends with the kind of disgraced town drunk. He was a former police officer who got like way drunk on the job. So then, you know, he lost his job. He lost his license. He literally never drove again. So he would just walk around town and like walk up the hill and come hang out at our house. But he was literally a tall, lanky guy, often in a gray shirt with a blue vest.
No way.
Oh, wow.
Shut the fuck up. That's not real.
And I have never made that connection until this moment.
Wow.
Wow. You have... Well, I would say in your own earnest. He sounds like he was probably a little less like earnest. I don't know how else to describe it. Like, less ridiculous. But you had your own earnest.
Kinda. Yeah.
Kind of.
Did you have any weird neighbors, Mary Beth?
Oh, Jesus Christ. I had so many weird neighbors. Because my stepdad... my stepdad is such a friendly person that he will make friends with anybody. And the problem is he's so friendly that people take that as an invitation as like, oh, we're best friends now.
Right.
So we had two neighbors growing up and they both were obsessed with my stepdad. And my stepdad was like, oh, we'd always mow their lawn for them. And like, who's so nice. But one in particular, this guy had pet birds. I think I've told this story before, but he would rescue old macaws, like macaws whose owners had passed away and the macaws were old and had outlived their owners. Uh-huh. So he would rescue these birds specifically. And, you know, he would walk like similar to the woman with the snake around her neck. He'd walk around with them and everyone like, oh, yeah, that's Joe. And then one day one of them flew into the ceiling and broke their neck. And he thought that the best idea would be to bring it over to our house, ask us how to handle it.
Oh, like brought the birds over?
Like brought the dead bird over.
Oh,
to our house. Like knocked on the door. And my mom was like, what? And he like handed the bird to my mom and was sobbing at our house. And like that story really encapsulates what he was like.
Wow.
And multiple times we had to help him bury his animals.
Oh, dear.
He had a lot of animals. He was a very sweet person. Like, he always got me Christmas presents. And, like, he was so nice. But he was also so weird. So, you know, well-meaning dude. But he definitely made me uncomfortable. Like, oh, can I tell you a creepy story? It just came back to me.
Please.
I used to want to, like, lay out in my backyard and get tan, even though I don't tan. And he would watch me tan. And then bought me a chair so I could sit in the grass and not have to lay on a towel, which like is nice in theory, but creepy that he was watching me and like would come outside every time I was laying out and then bought me a special chair for it.
Wow.
It's weirdo. Anyway, that memory just came flaming. It came like running back at me. Like, remember this weird dude that used to watch you lay out in your backyard?
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
Anyway, that's my story.
That's a wild one, though.
That's the story.
You know, this movie also made me nostalgic, though, because
when
they go run to get weapons to fight the trolls, they go and grab a super soaker.
Mm-hmm. Super soaker.
I had that exact one, too.
Me too. Me too. And, you know, let me tell you, living in Alaska, super soakers were expensive.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Like, I don't know how I have no, you know, when you live in Alaska, the idea of like how much things are worth is really weird. And I remember spending $60 for a super soaker.
And they were pretty expensive.
Like,
I don't know how much exorbitant they were back then, but they definitely, that makes sense that they were more in Alaska due to like everything else, but they were
importing
definitely still
and
pricey.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I had that exact model. I loved it.
Did you fill it with milk?
You know, I wanted to really bad. I never did, though. And this movie also made me really nostalgic for treehouses. Like, I really wanted a treehouse, and they make it seem so effortless to like create a treehouse in a day on that big gnarly tree.
I fucking wish it was that easy, because I had a treehouse growing up, but like it was a tree fort. It wasn't really built into a tree. It was like a little house on like a raised platform. My stepdad built it because my stepdad is like, he can do anything, but we didn't have enough trees to put it in, or like a tree that would support it, which bummed me the fuck out. I was like, I wanted it in a tree, but no. It turns out it's harder than you think to put a treehouse in an actual tree.
Yeah, it had a very similar thing.
Was it in an actual tree, or was it also on like a platform?
It was kind of raised. What it was it was kind of built like it was raised a little off the ground. It wasn't like in a tree, which I had thought it was going to be this thing in a tree, but it was kind of using four trees as like the base that this platform was built around.
Oh, cool.
And then it was like this big fort and like it had a drawbridge. It was built by like an old boyfriend of my mom's who really thought he was going to be my stepdad is basically it.
No.
Yeah. So he really went all out on that thing for that reason. Like a hammock in it. And, yeah. And I felt like so bad. It's like, it looked so cool. And then my friend and I tried to sleep in it once and we were like, this is miserable. Let's go back in the house.
Okay, I had the same experience. I was like, oh, cool, we'll sleep. Like, mine was not as cool as yours. Mine was small and had, like, a little front porch, but, like, it was very small. But we put, like, cool chairs in it, and it was so badass. It was hot. It's, like, not comfortable at all to sleep in, like, in the treehouse. I thought it'd be, like, so rad and cool. And then I'm like, wait, you can't get electricity out here. Like, I have to go inside to pee. It's hard to
get
bugs.
Snacks.
There's bugs. It's hot. Yes, I feel that. But my another funny story about my treehouse was as we got older, we still had it in the backyard. People I went to high school with apparently would sneak into it in the middle of the night and smoke weed in our treehouse.
Oh!
I know. My friend told me that like not that long ago. She's like, wait, you have that treehouse? I'm like, yeah, why? She's like, I used to sneak into it and smoke it because our backyard like bordered up against the main shopping center where like the grocery store was. And, like, I was like in a small town. So like the shopping center was like the only place to hang out. And then if you wanted to smoke weed, you'd go up the hill and like break into people's backyard. So they would climb into our treehouse and smoke weed.
Wow.
I lived in a weird place, I guess. But also with Super Soakers, we had Super Soaker fights all the time in my backyard. That was like our favorite activity as kids was to like have water fights. And my brothers collected water guns and they got crazy. Super Soakers got ridiculously complicated.
Multiple water bottles on it, like different, yeah. Like
sights.
Mm-hmm.
Like ridiculous pumping power.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah, no, I remember having like an all-out Super Soaker like war on one of my birthdays because my cousin, who was kind of the mean girl even in second grade, she really learned her thing early on, which I guess I give her credit for that. Like, you really knew you. But she, like, we just hated each other. And she was born the same week, so we often had our birthday parties on the same day.
Right.
And she lived only, like, you know, right on the other side of, like, the woods behind my house, like, not far away. And we had relatives all around us, so she'd be walking over. And we started squirt gunning her birthday party, and they started water ballooning us.
Yes.
And then it escalated and escalated, and it got, you know, it got over, it went over the line, but it was my mother that got it there. I will stand by that when we were, you know, throwing every Super Soaker we had at them. And then it was my mother, not any of us boys, that said, get the hose.
that is an escalation.
You know it's about to get fucking real when the parent goes get the hose, because I have experienced that too. Oh my god.
It's amazing.
Get the hose.
Okay, bringing it back to the movie though, I do, one of the things that I did appreciate sort of as an adult, more of like I don't know if this was intentional or not, but again, this is another movie that kind of is about the outsiders, because you have, you know, Eartha Kitt's character who, you know, she's one of the only POC non-white people in the movie. And she's looked upon kind of in derision as this woman that's living out the side of the town. She's kind of doing that junkyard art thing that we see again in like The Iron Giant, is sort of like, this is an outsider because they're, you know, doing something artistic with the people's junk. So you have her, you have Ernest, who does a vital job for the town, but he is also looked down on. And then you have the kids that are also being picked on by the mayor's kids. So you have like all these people that are sort of like this sort of people that are the social outcasts of this town, all banding together because no one else will believe them. And I that's kind of a trope I know that we see in a lot of kids' movies, but it's one that like it's like, oh, I can kind of see what they're kind of doing here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and the other thing I noticed too is that like the kids are the Ernest is the focus, but the kids are the one that like, oh, milk. It's milk that will get them. Mm-hmm. And yes. Like I know that's not like the end all, but it's a movie where even though there's like an adult, quote unquote, in the center of the movie, the kids right. are the smarter ones. Yes. They're the ones that figure things out. And that like has such a kids movie vibe. But also something I thought about was like, how fucked up is it in kids movies that like kids are the ones that always figure things out? And like how it's just always so funny to me when it's like, oh, the adults who act like they know everything, they're the ones that are absolutely like caught off guard and absolutely fucked up by all the trolls when they think they're going to fix it when they all drive out there with like their not literal pitchfork and torch situation, but they're all driving in a line up to where a tree is.
It's the people that are supposed to protect the kids and they can't.
And then it also puts Ernest in this weird space too of like, oh, he's the one that can save the kids, but he can't at first, but then he can. So it puts him in this weird space between kid and adult. And then when he hugs the troll and has the whole like heart of a child, unconditional love, pure of heart, and he's able to accomplish that and like defeat the troll. It's fascinating.
But how does he defeat the troll, Mary Beth?
Oh, he defeats the troll by giving it a big old hug and a big old smoocheroony right on the mouth.
Right on the snotty mouth.
Right on the and snotty mouth.
We get his catchphrase. I have to say, I think Trantor is. I think they were giving him some drag queen realness in this. Drag queens love a reveal, and he gets this glow up reveal at the very end that I just was living for as an adult, with like the thunder and the lightning and the flames bursting out of the ground, and he has. His face, you know, gets like, it's almost like he pulls off a wig and now he has even more like grotesqueries on him. And he's just like, he's owning himself and I love it. And he gives that line, not even milk can stop me now. And I'm just like, yes, queen.
Only love can melt her sad troll heart.
Speaking of changes in like appearance, one thing I picked up on this last rewatch that I thought was pretty clever is that I actually have to give it credit for this, is that the illustration of Trantor in the book is bald. So he has all the scraggly beard and like disheveled hair because he's been Rip Van Winkling in the ground for 100 years. And I just caught that and I like that approach.
I didn't even think about that. But I mean, this is what you get when you hire the Chiodo brothers, right? Mm-hmm. Is it Chiodo? Chiodo? How do you pronounce your last name?
I say Chiodo, because I know the band Chiodos. That's my only point of reference. I think it's Chiodo.
But I mean, they're turning in some really good work here. I was really surprised at the very end of the movie because I was thinking, oh, this is really the puppet work actually holds up really well. And then they announce, you know, that they are the ones that did. And it's like, oh, well, this makes perfect sense because they always make really great puppets.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And like Critters was another introductory, like it was a really early thing for me because those movies weren't rated R. So I was able to see them from a really young age. And for some reason, I just thought those were cool. Like those were actual little nightmare balls with teeth. And those didn't at the exact same age, those didn't terrify me nearly as much as this troll.
Oh, we need to get someone on the show to talk about the original Critters because I have a story about that movie.
But we haven't talked about the best character of this entire movie.
Who's that?
Rimshot.
Oh, the puppy.
Rimshot is a Jack Russell Terrier, or looks like one. And Jack Russell Terriers are a personal favorite in my home. Oh, there goes my cat. But also, he reminded me of Wishbone. Did either of you watch Wishbone growing up? Yes.
Yeah.
And also, I just love me a good dog sidekick who is basically as smart as a person, but just can't talk. I got very Wallace and Gromit vibes, if you guys ever watched Wallace and Gromit, of like the very nice kind of like naive owner and the very smart dog. I got very much Wallace and Gromit vibes, and I love Rimshot, even though I kept thinking his name was Rimjob.
You're not the first.
I definitely didn't think so, but I was like, I am definitely immature.
Yeah.
I cannot stop hearing that because it's the worst name for a dog. And that's what I have to say about that.
One thing about this movie is, like, I've heard this a lot because my thing in college became really early on, like, showing all these weirdo gonzo horror movies I grew up with or had discovered to all my friends who often had never seen any horror movies. But, like, I would sometimes go back to, like, these kid ones because, like, there's something about this movie that even into college I kept showing people. So I heard in college a lot about the dog who they insisted was named Rimjob.
Yeah.
And I remember, like, one night we finally got sick of all gathering in my dorm room to watch horror movies on my little TV, and we packed, like, my PS3 into somebody's backpack, and we went down to the student lounge and commandeered the giant TV in the student lounge for a double feature of Fright Night and Ernest Scared Stupid.
Incredible.
Wow. What a double feature.
And, like, I didn't realize that there was, like, a family thing going on with, like, kids running around and everything. So the mistake in retrospect was that we did Ernest Scared Stupid second.
Oh.
So that was, like, the late night movie.
I love that that was the closer.
Wow.
So this movie has been, like, following you your entire life.
Yeah, I mean, one, because, like, you know, I wasn't, like, I was, like, 19 or whatever, still terrified of it. But I was like,
right,
this is just so Halloween-y and buffoonish that I still think all my friends would get a kick out of it. But as a kid, it was a different story. There was nothing funny about this movie.
It's also celebrating its 30th anniversary this October, which is the other reason why we needed to get you on to do this. We wanted to talk your book, but it is celebrating its 30th anniversary.
90th anniversary. Ernest has been around for almost a whole century. Good Lord.
The other characters I really need to talk about are the weird, like, hucksters of all this useless crap.
Tom and Bobby?
God, yes!
Tom
and Bobby, who immediately were like, okay, what around our shop do we have right now that we could sell to a troll-loving poor sap like Ernest?
They end up taking him for $1,700.
Yes.
He didn't even bat an eye. He just, like, $1,700. I was like, where did Ernest get all that money?
Yeah. Yeah. But it also, like, resulted in, like, for whatever reason, we have those weirdo lines that just stick out to us, especially in the most random movies. And for whatever reason, the line has never left my memory is when he's talking to them on the radio, and he just refers to it as the country western troll you're so fond of.
Yes. And I love that when he buys it, it comes with an album of troll love songs.
Oh, like, my God. What about that album of every troll love song ever written?
Mm-hmm.
What?
Which I believe. Know what's on that.
Because that can't be very many songs.
Oh, my God. Well,
wow.
All right, Terry, how many ews out of five do you give Ernest Scared Stupid?
I mean, that's kind of a hard question for me to answer. Because I didn't really enjoy it as much as I expect to on this rewatch. Mary Beth, you said that it's definitely for kids, and I definitely think it is for kids. And I remember loving this movie when I saw it in the movie theater. I have some fond memories of it. I think the effects have aged pretty well, considering the fact that this was, like, a kid's movie. I don't know. It didn't do it as much as I wanted it to. I kind of saw some of the seams this time. Although I will say Jim Varney gives it his all. I think he really goes for broke in every single movie that he does. And I think that's pretty amazing and outstanding that he is attacking this with so much gusto of a role that he probably could phone in. And Eartha Kitt is love. I love her. I thought, I I wanted the whole movie to be about her. I thought some of her lines were just absolutely hysterical. I'm going to give it 3 oohs out of 5, mostly because of Eartha Kitt, because she just, I love her. What about you, Mary Beth?
So I'm going to have to give this 2.5 oohs. I think I just don't have the nostalgic context for it. I appreciate it 100% for what it is. I can see why it's considered so scary. People saw it back then, and the puppet work is incredible. I mean, you don't have to go that hard on a kid's movie, but they did, and I love that. Mm-hmm. When this was an era where I think people really cared more about horror for children, and like actually made it scary.
Yeah.
So I really love that. You know, I didn't really have the context for Ernest, so I was like, you're a little bit annoying, but I see why you're funny, because he's a character for kids, and like they definitely hit the mark with him that way, and I appreciate it 100% for that. But yeah, it's 2.5 ewes for me. Nat, you have the final word. How many ewes do you give this out of 5?
It's tough. Because, you know, as much as I don't like people saying to other people, like, oh, you only really like that because of the nostalgia for it. Like, I get it. I am all about saying it to yourself. And I recognize how much of my joy comes from the nostalgia, as terrifying as that nostalgia may have been. But, I still love it, seems and all, because it has no internal logic from one moment to the next. Like, the movie could very easily just be Ernest's, like, rambling excuse to why he's late to work the day after Halloween. It was just like, oh, well, there's this troll, and it was afraid of Miak. No, it was afraid of milk. And, But, it's still, you know, it is what it is. And, like, I love it, but could I give it 4? I don't think so. So I think Ernest does commit a few too many felonies. I think it's a solid 3.
I'm here for that. Well, thank you so much, Nat, for joining us to talk about Ernest Scared Stupid. Where can listeners find you, and what do you have coming up that you'd like to share?
Well, thanks so much for having me, first of all. Everybody can find me at Nat Bremmer on Twitter, and I have Puppet Master Complete, a franchise history coming up, obviously, as well as later this month. There is a issue of TV Guide's Remind magazine that is all about the Halloween franchise, and I have an article in that as well.
Awesome.
So that'll be on like newsstands and everything later this month.
Cool.
That's so cool.
That's awesome. That's really neat.
And people can pre-order your book everywhere. I saw it on Amazon. So is it...
Weird, because that's like how I found out like the release date and everything. Oh. So I just saw the Amazon listing one day, but that's true. But yeah, they can pre-order through the publisher, through McFarland, through Amazon, Barnes & Noble. I saw it on a textbook site the other day.
Oh, wow.
It's really the pre-order. It seems to be just about everywhere. Hopefully you can pre-order it.
And we'll put up a link to the McFarland in our show notes for everyone. So listeners, go check there.
So listeners, you've heard from us, but we want to hear from you. What was your experience with Ernest Scared Stupid? You can send us an email at scarredforlifepodcast@gmail.com, or you can reach out to us directly on Twitter. I am at MB McAndrews.
And I'm McGailey Dreadful.
And of course, don't forget to follow the podcast on Twitter at Scarred Podcast.
Please take a moment to give us a review, a rating, and please subscribe.
Thank you to Eric Power for our artwork. Thank you to Sean Keller for our music. Thank you everyone for listening. Please stay safe out there. But most important, stay creepy.
And until next time. We'll be right back.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
What is The Briefing Room?
It's a behind-the-scenes look at how the criminal justice system works and the lives of the people within that system.
If you love true crime, well, these are the real people who do the job every day of making sure justice is served.
Hi, I'm Detective Dave.
I'm Detective Dan. Together, we have decades of experience in local law enforcement, a profession that we think is often misunderstood.
So we're going to explore how to do it right, and we won't shy away from when it's done wrong. These are stories you'll hear nowhere else. Unique, frank, and unvarnished.
From the team that brought you Small Town Dicks, this is The Briefing Room. Episode 1 drops on August 30th. We'll meet you in The Briefing Room.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.